Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is a Republic if you can keep it. Political news and commentary with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer.
I'm Jeff Timmer. Welcome to the Trump's Pecker Problem edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It. It's OJ without the white Bronco as the first ever criminal trial of a former president gets underway, with the former publisher of the National Enquirer throwing Trump under the bus over his catch-and-kill strategy, which was a strategy for keeping Trump out of political trouble. Now it describes his legal predicament. He got caught, and it could kill his candidacy, his company, and possibly his freedom. New York law enforcement and corrections officials are reportedly conferring with the Secret Service on what to do if Trump is sent to jail for contempt of court. Arizona joins Michigan, Georgia, and Nevada in criminally charging fake electors, with Trump named an unindicted co-conspirator in both Michigan and Arizona and charged criminally in Georgia.
I'm Mark Brewer. Sexual predator Larry Nassar is now a $1 billion economic disaster, in addition to all the other damage that he has caused, as the U.S. Treasury is hit for a nearly $140 million settlement from the FBI to victims for slow-walking the investigation. That's on top of the $500 million paid out by Michigan State and the nearly $400 million paid out by USA Gymnastics for that terrible scandal. Another draconian anti-abortion law reaches the U.S. Supreme Court as Democrats continue to focus on women's reproductive freedom as issue number one. We're recording this week's podcast on Thursday, April 25th, which is the 10th anniversary of Flint's water supply being switched from Lake Huron to the Flint River, with the resulting poisoning of the residents of Flint. What lessons have we learned, and what lessons should we have learned from that terrible tragedy 10 years ago? Finally, the campaign for an open seat on the Michigan Supreme Court is underway, with control of the court in the balance. We'll talk with the likely Democratic nominee for that seat, University of Michigan law professor Kimberly Thomas, who was just this week endorsed by the Michigan Democratic Party's executive committee. But before we return to all that, Jeff, let's talk a little bit about legal developments. One thing we didn't mention in our opening is, as you and I are recording, Larry, the Supreme Court has just wrapped up argument in Trump's claim of immunity from the Jack Smith prosecution. You've got the ongoing criminal trial in New York, obviously. But then, as you and I just talked about, there were some revelations this week about his role as an unindicted co-conspirator in a number of these fake elector cases. Jeff, do you think that's going to have any political impact on the campaign at all?
I think that ultimately Trump's legal problems will have impact on the election. I don't think it's some kind of magic solution for democracy that if he's convicted, it's going to cause everything to implode. His support is fairly baked in. But what I think it does is galvanize the coalition of the sane, the coalition of the pro-democracy, pro-rule of law majority in the United States that doesn't think there's a separate system of justice for the president, that the president can do anything and it's not illegal. I mean, if that's the case, Joe Biden could have Donald Trump put in Guantanamo or have him assassinated, and that wouldn't be illegal. It's just ludicrous. And so I don't even think that despite the conservative Trump-appointed majority on the U.S. Supreme Court, that this court would set the precedent that there's a separate system of justice for the chief executive, that they're somehow immune from crimes committed while in office, or certainly before or after they leave office. But what I do think is we could see politics rear its head with the court if they delay the proceedings long enough that the Jack Smith trial doesn't get underway before the election is over.
Right. So it sounds like your view, and I agree with it, is that if there's an effect, it could be cumulative, right? But there's no single thing, like the revelations this week that Trump was an unindicted co-conspirator in a number of these cases, which frankly didn't surprise me. Everybody knew he was behind all these fake electors' schemes. But that it could be a cumulative effect on the election, but no single incident is going to make the turning point. And I think we've seen that in his history, right? Problem after problem, nothing seems to unbake the support that you just described. But I think on that small group of independent voters who could be influenced by this, there could be an effect. It does look like, and I'm just speculating here based on what we heard from the Supreme Court this morning, that Jack Smith is not going to be able to get that trial underway before the election. I hope the Supreme Court doesn't create a new broad level of immunity for the type of conduct that Trump engaged in. But there sounds like there's enough nuances and things that it's going to take a while to sort out after whatever court decision comes out. I must say, though, Jeff, that the pictures coming out of New York of him having to sit at that table, looking pretty forlorn, not in control, despite what he may be saying on social media and outside the courthouse, really cast him in a different light. And right, this is a guy who has spent his entire life protecting power, protecting being in control. He's not in control in that New York courtroom, and it put him in a very different light than we've seen in the past.
No, Trump is many things. Most of them are not good. One thing he has been is a blowhard bully his entire life, and certainly in his political career these last 8 going on 9 years. And as with many bullies, they're insecure, ineffective, and toothless when you really push them and push back on them. And that's what the judicial system, the criminal justice system, is doing. Trump's bravado, his smoke and mirrors tough guy act, holds no water inside a courtroom. He doesn't get to put on his theatrical displays and fiction of being this strong, tough guy. He's a criminal defendant in that courtroom like anybody else would be, and he's being treated as such, and that's the way the system is supposed to work. Now, outside the courtroom, he is doing everything possible, I think, to dare the judge to hold him in contempt, to jail him, to make his political facade that much stronger among his acolytes. That seems like what he has doing with constantly pushing the envelope on this gag order, on threatening witnesses, on threats involving the judge and others. It seems like Trump is daring the court to give him an optics, what he would consider an optics public relations win on the outside of the trial. And so far, the judge has refused to take the bait. At what cost to the criminal justice system? I don't know.
Yeah, there's no question that the criminal justice system, the justice system in general in this country, has been under terrible stress and assault by Trump and his ilk for years. That's part of their overall strategy of undermining confidence in institutions, whether it be the institution of voting, democracy, of being held accountable in the courts, et cetera, et cetera. And this is a part of his ongoing effort. But Jeff, I'd like to talk about something we didn't mention in the opening, something that occurred since you and I last spoke. And that was, to me at least, and this is, I think, another ding at Trump. Congress last weekend on a bipartisan basis passed, finally, that foreign aid package. Taiwan, Israel, Ukraine, humanitarian aid for Gaza, passed on a bipartisan basis in the House. And I think it hasn't passed the Senate yet this week. It's going to. Seems to be an extraordinary rebuke of Trump and a great victory for Speaker Johnson. It might cost him his speakership, not yet, but there's continuing threats in that regard. But I was greatly relieved to see that. What do you think are the political consequences of that breakthrough on Capitol Hill?
It seems that the most likely consequence is there's going to be more infighting and cannibalizing on the Republican side. I've been a critic of Speaker Mike Johnson. I think he is a dangerous public figure. I don't agree with most of what he has done and stood for, but I do have to commend his conversion on the foreign aid bill, especially involving Ukraine, which has become just an embarrassment for the United States and for the Republican Party, that they would be, as a party, and still as a majority of Republicans, still beholden to Donald Trump and the pro-Russia, pro-Putin, anti-democracy, authoritarian regime of Russia. It showed that, well, despite the fact that Johnson did what was the right moral thing, he's probably likely to pay a political price. It doesn't seem that the knives are quite as sharp for Johnson throughout the caucus as they were for Kevin McCarthy last year, but the margin for Johnson, the majority margin, has become much thinner than what McCarthy had. So I'm not exactly sure of the math. McCarthy, I think there were 8 Republicans that voted to oust him, and the Democrats didn't do anything to throw a lifeline. There are 3 Republicans so far who say they will certainly vote to oust Johnson. It remains to be seen if the Democrats are going to step in and if they would need to step in and save Johnson's speakership. It's from their perspective, I imagine, a damned if you do, damned if you don't proposition. But I think it does point out one thing right now. The most powerful person in Congress on Capitol Hill doesn't seem to be Speaker Mike Johnson, doesn't seem to be Majority Leader Chuck Schumer over in the Senate, or the Minority Leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell. It looks to me to be Minority Leader in the House, Hakeem Jeffries, who's holding the most powerful cards on Capitol Hill right now, because he was able to broker this deal between Johnson, some of the Republicans in the House, his caucus in the White House and Senate. It really seems like this was a big feather in the cap for Johnson as he's making his quest to become the outright speaker next year after the election.
I think you're right on that point. Democrats to the rescue again. Leader Jeffries, I almost called him speaker, but we'll stop short on that, has really wielded the fact that he has a united caucus very, very effectively. A number of substantive bills have passed, not enough by any means, with the bills last weekend being the most recent ones. And again, he holds the fate of Johnson in his hand. I think the margin for the Republicans in the House has shrunk even further, Jeff. I think there have been a number of vacancies now. Somebody announced their resignation last weekend. Johnson's margin may be down to 3 or 4 at this point in terms of defectors that he can tolerate unless the Democrats come to his rescue.
And there was a death of a Democratic incumbent yesterday from New Jersey. And so I'm not sure what that does to that mathematical equation on the ouster vote. I guess we need a scorekeeper to figure out what it's going to take, how many votes from the Republicans to successfully remove Mike Johnson. If Marjorie Taylor Greene goes forward with and pursues her motion to vacate, which I believe at this point has just been a threat and not actually a looming out there, though she doesn't appear to be backing down from it. Switching gears a little bit here, we talked about this in the open. The list of unindicted co-conspirators here in Michigan, which contained several names of renown in political circles, including former Republican Speaker Tom Leonard and his wife, who's also been a political operative and the owner of a political consulting firm. Does it mean that it doesn't mean anything at all to be an unindicted co-conspirator? Is it just a notorious asterisk that goes on your name? Is there any liability or potential repercussions? I'd be curious, since Tom Leonard has desired a political future. He ran again for attorney general in 2022, lost at the convention, the Republican convention, but still fancies himself a potential aspirant to nomination for some office in the Republican Party. Is this going to be a political demerit for him, being an unindicted co-conspirator?
No, Jeff, you raise a good point. Of course, his wife, as you mentioned, is the owner, operator of a very prominent Republican consulting firm in Lansing. I think the answer, Jeff, depends on what happens with the underlying case. And to remind our viewers, this information came out in the course of the preliminary examination of these fake electors. There's a judge in Lansing looking at all the evidence, and then she will decide whether there's enough evidence to send these fake electors to trial. And in the course of that this week, the investigator from the Attorney General's office indicated that there were not only the Leonards, but several others who were not indicted, but are regarded as co-conspirators in this process. I think the ultimate damage to Leonard, both Leonards, will depend on what happens at the trial. If these folks are found innocent in some way, then I think the damage goes away. If there are convictions, then I think people say, aha, you were associated with this criminal activity. My guess is, Jeff, given the MAGA control of the Republican Party, though, probably doesn't make any difference in him. Even hell, the Leonard's inside the current Republican Party. But I think, again, if there are convictions, I think it'll have a bigger impact outside the Republican Party, perhaps with voters watch, particularly if you've got somebody like Leonard, who wants to run for attorney general again in the future, the top law enforcement official in the state. Not a good look. To be an unindicted co-conspirator in a criminal conspiracy to basically overturn the election results with these election deniers.
Yeah, now you have to go all the way back to Kevin Cotter, who served as speaker for one term more than a decade ago, to find a Republican who hasn't been a speaker, who hasn't been indicted or named as an unindicted co-conspirator. You've got Rick Johnson and Lee Chatfield. Tom Leonard is under a cloud now, and former speaker Jason Wentworth is under a cloud involving some appropriations that were conducted while he was speaker. And so there's quite a storm cloud of illegality that has formed around Republican legislative leaders of recent note.
Yeah, I know that sounds right, Jeff. But I would like to turn, if we can, my friends, there have been some developments on the abortion front this week. Despite the Supreme Court's statement in Dobbs, abortion continues to come back to them. They had argument earlier this year on the effort to basically ban mifepristone, which is an important part of medication abortion in this country. And this week, they heard an argument out of a case in Idaho in which virtually a complete ban, except for threatened death of the woman in Idaho in case of abortion, conflicts with a federal law which mandates that hospitals provide emergency care. And so the court ends up wrestling with that again, despite, again, their effort after Dobbs to get rid of these kind of cases. And all that was coupled with, I'm sure you saw, Jeff, the Arizona legislature this week voted to repeal that now infamous 1864 ban on abortion in Arizona that was upheld by the Arizona Supreme Court a couple weeks ago. We'll see if that ever goes anywhere. It's still got to get through the Senate and so forth. But that's just amazing to me, see that kind of political reaction from a defensive position by the Republicans in Arizona.
I think it just underscores the saliency and power of the political forces that were unleashed with the Dobbs decision. It is going to be, I think, a multi-election yoke that the Republican, the pro-life Republicans, they're all pro-life, all anti-abortion. And so it's going to be, it's not just a messaging problem, as some of the Republicans are trying to nuance their messaging on the issue without changing their underlying position. Or if they were to change their underlying position, that would be met with a high degree of cynicism from the voting public, because they would see it as not something to be believed. It would just be paying lip service to such a transformation for political expediency. And so I think that this is going to be a very powerful issue in not just in Arizona or in the states that are tackling these laws or having zombie laws like Arizona's 1864 statute resuscitated. It sends a signal for what could happen in other states. And I think it motivates and adds an element of urgency to this issue and keeps it on the forefront of voters' minds, despite Republicans' best efforts to minimize where this issue stands on the hierarchy of things that are motivating people at the polls.
I know, I think that's right, Jeff. Now, the pro-life forces in this country, in every state, have been very persistent in their efforts ever since Roe v. Wade in a wide variety of ways to put legislative limitations on the right to abortion. All those votes now and all those statements by people like Mike Rogers over the years are going to compact the harm thumb and can claim to change their position, but they have such a lengthy record, particularly someone like Rogers in the Congress, in the Michigan legislature, that presuming it's a Alyssa Slotkin or whoever it is on the Democratic side, I just see Rogers, again, presuming he's the nominee, I think he's going to be at this point, just getting pounded, compounded and pounded on abortion. They're not going to let him get away with these changes in position now as he is scrambling like everybody else. I think it's so ironic, again, that we had Trump a couple of weeks ago saying, well, we should leave this to the states. Okay, that means Arizona's 1864 law. That means Idaho's ban, which they argue overrides this federal mandate that you provide emergency care to people, not just women, but to people in general. It's back to the states, and it's still causing more than heartache to all these Republican candidates for office up and down the ballot. I expect to see abortion being an issue in local races. This week, you may have seen, Jeff, the Ottawa County Commission, controlled by Ottawa Impact, adopted a resolution, very much anti-abortion, pro-life, as they say. I think that could be an issue in some of those county commission races in Ottawa County. And I think while they thought they were doing the right thing in pursuit of their ideological agenda, they could pay a political price at the polls for that on the county commission.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based polling firm with nearly four decades of experience in accurately measuring public opinion.
Epic MRA has conducted surveys measuring voter opinions on ballot issues for more than 180 of Michigan's public school districts and nearly half of Michigan's intermediate school districts, including bonds, building and site sinking funds, special education and career technical millages, and non-homestead tax renewal proposals, as well as numerous other proposals for counties, municipalities, and community colleges across the state.
If you have a ballot proposal seeking voter approval, Epic MRA can measure voter support and the reasons why voters cast their vote. Epic MRA is nationally recognized for its polling expertise and is regularly quoted by news media across the nation.
Epic MRA is the go-to Michigan polling firm and also a proud sponsor of this podcast.
Ben Franklin may have invented the Franklin stove to stay warm, but we go Ben one better.
We have the Ben Franklin hoodie dedicated to Americans for Sanity.
But wait, there's more. Our merch store has coffee mugs for Democrats, uncrazy Republicans, and free-thinking independents, as well as t-shirts for the discerning democracy lover. Just click on the Merch Center link on our homepage, arepublicpodcast.com. Show your support for political sanity at the podcast merch store. It's your duty as an American.
The Michigan Democratic Party's Executive Committee has formally endorsed Kimberly Thomas for the open seat on the Michigan Supreme Court, an opening created when Republican Justice David Viviano decided against running for re-election. Thomas is a clinical professor of law and the director and co-founder of the Juvenile Justice Clinic at Michigan Law, and also teaches in the Civil Criminal Litigation Clinic. She specializes in trial and appellate practice, youth justice, in criminal sentencing law.
In 2017, Thomas served as a United States Fulbright Scholar at the University College Cork School of Law in Cork, Ireland, and is a former editorial board member of the Clinical Law Review. Before joining the University of Michigan Law School faculty in 2003, she also served as a trial attorney with the Defender Association of Philadelphia, as well as previously serving as a law clerk to a federal judge. And if I mean the full disclosure, I am Kimberly Thomas's campaign and election lawyer.
Kimberly Thomas, thank you for joining us on A Republic, If You Can Keep It. Let's start here with what propels you to seek elected office statewide here in Michigan for the state Supreme Court?
Well, thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Mark. It's so great to be here. I really appreciate coming on your podcast. I would like to be a justice of the Michigan Supreme Court, fundamentally because I care so deeply about the quality of justice that's delivered for people in the state of Michigan. I can't emphasize how important that is. We really need court systems where people have confidence in those systems and where people feel like they're being treated fairly in the systems. And so that's why I'm running for the Justice of Michigan Supreme Court.
That's something that we were just talking about in the conversation that Mark and I were recording before you joined us, about this political assault on the criminal justice system, on the rule of law, trying to undermine people's faith in the judicial system as it's now coming to hold former President Trump and several of people close to him accountable for their actions, especially around the 2020 election. But what are, I guess, some of the how does the court rehabilitate faith in the wide swath of the populace, the pro-democracy, pro-rule of law majority that exists in this country, if you have this, maybe arguably the U.S. Supreme Court taking what people view as political stances on matters of law?
Yeah, so obviously I know that people's confidence in the U.S. Supreme Court is really at a low, their confidence in the integrity of that court. And we have to do better here in Michigan at the state Supreme Court level. The state courts hear 95% of the cases in our country. And so it's so important that we restore people's faith in these courts. There's work that obviously the state Supreme Court makes case-by-case decisions on important issues. The state Supreme Court also acts as an administrator for our entire court system. And so, for example, the court is working on a program called the Michigan Judicial Council right now that is seeking to increase the transparency of our courts, to make courts across the state have uniform data systems, to make them user-friendly. So all of these things are part and parcel of the work on the state Supreme Court, and I'm so excited to do that work.
You and I have run into each other on the campaign trail quite a bit. And I can tell you, as a longtime practitioner of Michigan politics, it's great to see our candidates out there, particularly judicial candidates who sometimes don't seem to enjoy campaigning very much. I've seen you in Northern Michigan, across the state, evenings, weekends. You're out there. Can you seem to really enjoy campaigning? Tell us a little bit about your experience so far as you're campaigning. What are people asking about? What are you learning as you campaign?
I am learning that people care tremendously about our state Supreme Court. And so that's really exciting. I think that state Supreme Courts have been in the news. People understand that what the impact of that nonpartisan ballot can be on their day-to-day lives. And so that is definitely something that I'm hearing on the campaign trail. I'm a marathoner, and so I definitely have trained for this. I'm really enjoying going out, talking to people, hearing what's happening in their communities and what they care about in their court systems. And so that's been a real pleasure for me.
What is the level of knowledge out there about the court system and the role of the Michigan Supreme Court? Is there a real need for further education out there by candidates like you and others?
I think it varies. I think some people are really aware of the sort of high profile. Obviously, the courts make these sort of individual decisions that are in the newspapers that scratch the surface. So some people are certainly aware of that work of the court. And I think people are less aware of the more mundane day-to-day work that has the problem-solving work that the courts do, especially the Michigan Supreme Court, and that collaborative problem-solving work that has to happen to make the courts work for everybody. So it varies. I think that the other thing is just helping people understand to keep voting on that nonpartisan ballot when they're in the voting booth this fall. In 2022, there was a big drop-off between the people that voted for the governor and the people that voted for the state Supreme Court, and helping people appreciate how important their individual vote is for all of these offices, including the state Supreme Court.
Now, you're running for what is a rare thing in Michigan, an open seat on the Michigan Supreme Court. Very rare, right? Usually we have incumbents or somebody leaves and someone gets appointed, but you're actually in an open seat race. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the dynamics of your race? What's the length of the term? What's the ballot going to look like? Those kinds of things.
Yes, thank you. So it's an open seat. Terms on the Michigan Supreme Court are 8 years. There are two Michigan Supreme Court races this year. One race is Justice Kyra Harris Bolden's seat. She has to rerun for the remainder of her term. So that's a single head-to-head race that will be on the ballot this fall. And the second Michigan Supreme Court race that'll be on the ballot this fall is the race that I'm running for, which is a head-to-head race for a one term that's an 8-year term. So it's a brand new term that's an open seat.
And now, again, our listeners, you're not nominated to the primary process, right? We just had filing deadline this week and a lot of candidates get on the ballot that late. Your nomination process, even though you're a nonpartisan candidate, is a little different. Can you explain to our listeners how Supreme Court justice candidates get nominated?
Yes. The way the regulations are for the elections is that state Supreme Court candidates are nominated by a political party to be on the ballot. And so in my instance, I'm seeking the nomination of the Democratic Party. The Michigan Democratic Party Executive Committee announced yesterday that they are endorsing me for the state Supreme Court, as well as Justice Kyra Harris Bolden. And so each party that wants to participate in the state Supreme Court race nominates their candidate instead of a primary process.
Right. And then you're listed on the ballot. It's a nonpartisan race, as you indicated. So those people that vote straight party or prefer one party over the other, casting that kind of ballot and doesn't affect your race. They have to go find your race on the ballot and vote individually. Is that right?
That's right. So no matter what, you vote on the top of the ticket for the state Supreme Court, as well as the other judges that are on the ballot, on the nonpartisan ballot. Voters need to continue voting to do their homework and educate themselves about the justices that they want to serve and keep voting.
The Michigan Supreme Court seems to maybe perhaps be an outlier in politics in the Trump era. You could make the argument that it was more partisan and more divided before Trump than it is since Trump was elected president. We have a situation now, Democratic justices are a majority of the state Supreme Court. However, the Chief Justice, selected by the other justices, is one appointed by and elected as a Republican nominee. That really seems, well, maybe normal in the four times politics, but out of place in this highly partisan, hyper-partisan political world we find ourselves in. Do you see that kind of collegiality or bipartisan focus on the law and the nonpartisan aspect of being an appellate judge? Do you find that it enables you to build a bipartisan or a coalition that kind of crosses the partisan spectrum?
Thanks, Jess. It's important that justices are on the nonpartisan ticket. We want everyone who's voting, everyone who elects a justice, no matter who they are, to believe that they're going to get a fair hearing before the court, that the court is going to be for them, no matter their political party, their race, their ethnicity, where they're coming from in the state. Everybody needs to feel that these justices are their representatives. And so that's the value of having that nonpartisan designation. And certainly there's a need for the justices to work cooperatively and to listen to each other. And really, I know that may be old fashioned in justice land, but it's incredibly important. I think that's what helps promote people's confidence in the court.
I think as a practicing lawyer in the state, I really credit a lot to former Chief Justice McCormick, the changing the culture in the court. All of her colleagues contributed to as well. Don't get me wrong. But I really did notice when she became chief, a change in the culture of the court seemed much more cooperative, much more collaborative, working as colleagues, even though they may have vastly different views. And I think that helps instill confidence by all of us out here who have to live with your decisions, that decisions are fair and done in a nonpartisan fashion. So I know you'll contribute to building that culture and restoring it at the Michigan Supreme Court. We turn to, I think our listeners and I should like to know a little bit about your background, personal and professional. Give us a little flavor of how you came to be teaching at the University of Michigan and a little bit about your background and interests.
Yeah. So my personal background, my family is originally from the coal country in Pennsylvania. So my grandfather was a coal miner and they moved. My dad was a Vietnam era veteran. They settled in Maryland. So I grew up in Maryland. I was the first person in my family to go straight to college from high school. I went to the University of Maryland and I graduated from the University of Maryland and got what I thought was my dream job as a reporter for the Detroit News. So I had a life before law school. That was in 1994. I moved to Michigan. And then in 1995, I was a member of one of the unions that went out on strike at the Detroit newspapers. And based on my sort of interests, based on that experience, I decided to shift my career and go to law school from there. So I went from Detroit to Harvard Law School, where I got my law degree. And then after law school, I worked for a federal court of appeals judge in a clerkship, which is a one-year apprenticeship program under a judge. And then I worked as a lawyer in Philadelphia and then came to the law school here at University of Michigan.
Of quite a story. Kimberly, I've heard you on the campaign trail, and I've heard you tell a very touching story about your grandfather. Would you be willing to share that with our listeners?
Yeah, so my grandfather, actually, he dropped out of school to work in the coal mines and spent his career in the coal mines in northeastern Pennsylvania. It's an anthracite mining community. And so I was just a kid. And so he's my grandfather who I adore. And despite his lack of formal education, I thought he was like the smartest guy, right? So I thought he was great at math and he read poetry. And so he would make me bacon when I come to visit him. And so I didn't see him as just a coal miner. I saw him as this really neat guy who he drank PBRs and smoked Camels and just was let me win his cards, right? But I think that one thing was when he went to get black lung insurance, people in my family worried that he would be judged because he was a smoker, that would impact the adjudication of his case. People worried in my family that because they were not a family of means, they were not a family with fancy connections, that he wouldn't be able to get those benefits after a lifetime of work in the coal mines. And so those kinds of things are what motivate me to understand that our court system needs to serve people, people need to feel like that's not what matters, who you're connected to or how much money you have, that it's really the court system and our process is there to serve everyone. And so that's really foundationally important to me.
Is there anything else that you want to share with us in terms of your judicial philosophy, your approach to how you would rule on the Michigan Supreme Court where you can be elected there?
Yeah, I've been a law teacher for 20 years. So I think that brings with it, for me, it brings with it really a commitment to research, to getting it right, to making sure that the law is accurate and appropriately applied. And so just 100% putting in the research work to make sure that the court is correctly deciding the cases. The other thing that teaching students has given to me is every year there's a new group of students and they have incredible faith, this next generation of law students, in the power of our law to be the best it can be, to really improve, to really serve people. And they come with incredible optimism about the role of law in our community. And that's hard to not catch from them, to really think that, yes, the law can serve people and the law can serve everyone. And they come with that belief, this next generation of lawyers. And I think that's amazing. And I really owe to them that ability to believe that.
Well, before we let you go, if folks are interested in learning more about you or getting involved in your campaign, is there a website, an email address? What's your social media presence so that people can be in touch with your campaign?
Yes. So my website is electkimberlythomas.com and all the information about me is there as well as my social media. So I would love to connect with people. Hopefully I will see more and more of your listeners out across the state of Michigan as I'm traveling around and talking to voters. So I'm really, thank you so much, Jeff and Mark, for having me. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your podcast.
And I know judicial candidates are handcuffed when it comes to asking for donations, but I imagine your campaign website probably has a function where people can do donate to your campaign should they be so inclined. So if anybody listening is inspired, please check out that website and contribute to Kimberly Thomas's campaign. Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
That's it for this week's Chat Fest. Our thanks to Professor Kimberly Thomas for being part of our week.
If the Republic is still standing and surviving Trump's trials and indictments, we'll be back in a week.
A Republic, If You Can Keep It, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer, is a copyrighted production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.